You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
War, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. Tonight's episode is Best of Both Worlds, and I'm Blair from Ontario, Canada.
And I'm James from London.
And I'm Blue from Nebraska. Blair from Ontario, Canada. Cold up there?
It's been cold the last few days, yes.
Have you heard?
Finally got winter.
Really? Have you heard about the massive blizzard heading our way?
I know the Washington area and all that got hit pretty hard. But, we don't see anything on our end, so which is good. But I'm in the southern Ontario part, so we don't get hit nearly as bad as some of the other places in Canada.
Nice. Okay, by blizzard, Doc, I want you to fully understand. When you get snow and you get that quarter inch that shuts London down, right? They're calling between Monday night, Tuesday morning to Wednesday morning, an accumulation of 16.6 inches of snow. It'd be about 6 inches of snow Tuesday morning when we wake up. And throughout the day, they're calling for what they call thunder snow.
Thunder snow sounds so great. I mean, that's fantastic. That's like something out of War of the Worlds, isn't it? Thunder snow.
It is going to be enormous. And Omaha has had two snowfalls that have accumulated about 5 inches or so. And it's shut us down where the streets weren't getting plowed. Cars were getting stranded, couldn't go up hills. This year, for some reason, I think our city is really dropping the ball on snow plows. But the mayor has promised to get better on this. So we'll see what happens this coming Tuesday. And you know,
do they salt and sand your roads as well there, Lou?
Yes, they do. Or they're supposed to. But in the last couple days, it doesn't seem like they have. And I don't know. Well, last couple storms, I should say. So we'll find out. And you know what's funny is I did 10 years in the pizza delivery business in every conceivable weather possible. Okay, trying to make a 30-minute guarantee in an ice storm was pretty good. You know, that's what Domino's did back then. 30 minutes or it was free. And then it was 30 minutes or you get $3 off. And now they stopped doing that. And every pizza delivery is a good hour now.
Now, if you got stranded, though, you know you wouldn't go hungry.
Right. Yeah, I suppose. Oh, there were a couple times I got into an accident. And while I was waiting for the police to show up, I ate the guy's pizza. Does them no good now.
Yeah.
But, you know, as I get older, I can't stand this. I cannot stand driving on ice and snow anymore. I just get so scared. And but anyway. So, Blair, you're coming to us from Upper Pylon 2. How's that going for you?
It's going great. We are currently in season 2, and we're probably over the midway mark. Yeah, you joined us there on the episode Whispers, which, you know, the whole time travel thingy, which aired this week for us. But by the time you guys hear this, it will probably...
Did you say time travel thingy? No, that's the next one I'm on is going to be... I can't think of what it's called, but that's going to be the time travel thingy. No, this one is where... Miles is believes that everybody else has gone crazy.
No. What I mean is, you know, due to temporal dynamics, you know, people have heard this.
Yes.
By the time they're listening to this, you will have been on our show quite some time ago, and probably a few weeks back.
That's true. That is true.
And I encourage you to go listen to Lou. He did a great job.
Did I really?
It was good.
I was doing my best, man, because I felt so intimidated being such around masters of the art.
Oh, I'm no master, let me tell you. You know, this is just it's a lot of fun. It's good to always have somebody else on. It always gives a different perspective.
Yes.
And it can be challenging at times too, because when you have your regular hosts, and we do tend to have 4 to 5 hosts at a time, and then we throw in a guest, we normally find that the normal hosts really have to kind of make an effort to make sure that the guest host has a good opportunity, you know, because everyone hears us every week. It's a great opportunity to listen to somebody new. And in some cases too, you know, when they listen to you and hear how good you are on our show, it opens up doors if they've never listened to your podcast to give it a listen as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's kind of how I found podcasting, you know, started with the Delta Quadrant years ago. And then I came on your show a few times before I started Upper Pylon 2. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would say I'm still a novice, that's for sure. Some of the hosts on the show, like Matt and Melissa, they're certainly the veterans of, mm-hmm. You know, the format that both shows kind of do.
You're right. And, you know, sometimes I even notice us when we have guests on, we tend to talk a lot more than the guest. It's like the guest is sitting back listening to these guys, and you know, they're not involved as much. But I noticed when I was recording, that's what Melissa was doing. I mean, she was stopping everything to go, "So Lou, now what do you think?" And like, I like that. That is very sweet, and she's making sure that if you're going to be on her show, you're going to get some talk time. And that's
exactly.
Yeah.
And I know as a guest on your show and even the Delta Quadrant years ago, I was very intimidated, same thing. And I didn't want to break the flow. So you say your point and you be quiet and you let the other people talk, and then you hope you're kind of invited back in. But it takes a little bit of time too, as a show goes on, and the more guest hosts they have, the more used to it and the more flow it becomes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, but I want to tell you something about season two. I did not take notes for the Best of Both Worlds until today. And I even had an overnight shift at work. And it would have been a good time for me to watch the Best of Both Worlds. But instead, I was just more interested in listening to season two of Upper Pylon 2. Some of the last episodes I've heard, and admittedly I'm on like episode 5 that I'm listening to. I'm catching up. I gave up on Star Trek podcasting for a while and was doing Lord Lore and others. And then I had to stop doing them and get back to Upper Pylon. And I got to tell you something, you people are superb in your analysis of the episodes. Are so, so in depth. And you know, I like the fact that you guys are such a cohesive group. I don't know what we miss outside our outtakes of good arguments. I hear some good arguments, and you guys each all have points that you want to put out. And then at the end of the day, you're still in love with each other. And that's a good thing. I mean, you guys are really, really good at what you guys are doing. So I just want to mention, if you have not listened to Upper Pylon 2, you are missing something. And you really need to check it out, because we do our show like they do their show. So if you like us, there's no reason you can't like them.
Yeah, well, thanks for the kind words, Lou. We really appreciate that. And we do some editing there where we have to take some stuff out.
Yeah.
But it's amazing that for a group that, outside of maybe guesting on the Delta Quadrant before, we'd never really been all together as a group. And we hit it off right off the bat. And it's amazing how many times we're emailing or texting each other. I usually email, but how often we're doing it throughout the week. And it's not even just about Star Trek stuff. It's just about life. And we're always keeping in touch with one another, our personal lives. And we have a great time doing it. And
right.
Yeah. And like I said, we'd love to have both of you guys back on. James, you know, Lou's been on once. We would love to have you on and then maybe get you both on together one time. That would be a lot of fun.
Oh, that would be interesting. Okay. All right, then, here, let me put... I forgot to do this, so when you are ready to do the synopsis, Blair, let's go for it.
The synopsis for tonight's show is, the Borg begin an invasion of Federation space much sooner than was expected. While the Enterprise unable to affect them, the Borg capture Captain Picard and turn him into one of their own. This is the Season 3 finale, and is also the 26th episode of Season 3 of Star Trek The Next Generation, and was originally released on June 18th, 1990. It was written by Michael Piller and directed by our favorite Bolian, Cliff Bol. The guest stars include Elizabeth Delaney as Commander Shelby, George Murdoch as Admiral J.P. Hansen, Colm Meaney from Deep Space Nine, eventually, as Miles O'Brien, and special guest star Whoopi Goldberg as Guinan.
So, what do we think about this episode now? Blair, why don't you start us off?
Well, there's a reason why I signed up for, you know, the Battle Bridge for this episode. This episode is by far one of the best in not only Star Trek The Next Generation, but I think in Star Trek as a whole. Yeah, it has it all. It has action. It has, you know, has great action. The music score, and I'm not a huge music person, but it certainly sets the tone for the episode. Mm-hmm. This is definitely, you know, everyone's on board for this. And as I always like to say, I find that all episodes of Trek, when it's not focused on one character rather than when it's focused on everybody, tends to produce some of the better episodes. And this is certainly an example of that.
Mm. James, what about you?
Okay, so this is... I don't really quite know where to go on this, because I think that this episode is super, and I think it's great and it's fantastic. And I was watching it earlier today as well, and kind of rewatching in anticipation of this show. And I was kind of trying to just pick it apart to see, you know, how it was constructed and what were they doing so right. And I think that there's so much good stuff that they're doing well here. There's a lot of, you know, they really hit a lot of high notes on a lot of the structure, the writing, the acting, the guest stars, blah blah blah, the story, all of it. And I think that, you know, throughout this review, I'm putting up, kind of raising these things and things that I like about this episode, because, you know, but Best of Both Worlds, of course, is already known as being a great episode, and I was just trying to figure out whether or not, you know, this is the best episode of Trek that, you know, Next Generation did. And I was struggling with that so much earlier on today to figure out whether or where I would rank this. But I think at the end of the day, I don't think it matters. I'm going to just take you through really what I think are the high points. And then, you know, after a long thought, maybe in the next couple of years, I'll tell you which ones came out on top. But I thought that, you know, this episode is clearly fantastic. And but everyone knows that, right? Mm-hmm. This isn't earth shattering that we like this episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, this is, as far as whether it's the best of Star Trek at the time, yeah, I would agree with that. But I like a lot of heartfelt stories. So I actually would say Inner Light would probably top this one, to be honest with you. These kind of things, you know, Picard goes through this whole lifetime in a span of 20 minutes, and we go through it with him. And that's why I think Inner Light probably will top this episode. But in for what we've done...
Can I keep... Let me give you an analogy of what I think this is like. It's like, you know, very often people will have their favorite musician or whatnot, and they'll say, you know, what's the best song that the person ever did or the band ever did? And that, you know, with certain musicians, there's kind of a breakout phase where there's like almost a quantum leap, where it went from being a niche thing to being extremely big all of a sudden. And it then afterwards, what comes afterwards is often does, like, you know, hit very good heights. And people can still think, well, you know, this song later in the career was better than the one earlier. But sometimes you're always just brought back to the thing that was just so monumental in it. And, you know, you can claim that, you know, the later stuff was good, and the, you know, the stuff in Enterprise was very good as well. But I just think that there's such a, you know, this transcended, well, this was a game changer for Star Trek, in my mind. And I think I look at it and I wanted to go back thinking, is it just, is there too much rose-tinted glasses here? Do we, is it actually as good as people remember it being? And I think there are some episodes in TOS in particular that I don't think are as good as people remember them being. But with this one, I really couldn't find much at all to fault with it. And I thought that everything they were trying to accomplish really still holds up to this day.
Mm. Well, I think for myself, James, I think you bring up a good point. It's always the rose-colored glasses. Is the past always better than what it really was? And I just still recall being in high school at the time. And when this, waiting all summer long in the anticipation, and everybody was talking about it at in school. And there weren't that many Star Trek fans in high school at the time, but everybody knew a bit about it. And that's what I think I remember most about it, was just the anticipation. And when we get to the second part, I think it was fulfilled as well. And I think that's what, for me, makes it so good, that even 30 or 25, 30 years later, that it can still be such a, I still have fond memories of it. And I think that's why it still sits with me. Yeah, there's the inner light. And I must admit, I hated the inner light for the first couple times. It wasn't until I was much older that I actually appreciated it more. But this is one of the few episodes where I probably didn't even need to watch the episode this week. I did, but I probably could have remembered everything about the episode and written notes without even having to pop it in the DVD player.
That is true. Yeah, of course, I was thinking the same thing. Why do I need to really watch it to review it? But no, you have to. So, okay, so let's see where we begin. The Enterprise has arrived to Jurei 4 in response to a distress signal, and they confirm what sensors tell them. There's no life form. In fact, the planet's town center is nothing but a massive crater in the ground. So who could have done this? Does this not seem like crystalline entity work?
I know you have that theory, Lou, that you always kind of thought the Romulan incursions in the neutral zone, mm-hmm. that whole discussion. I know you were a big believer that it was the crystalline entity. I buy it. I automatically think it's the Borg. That being said, you know, you do see the teasers ahead of time, so you're kind of spoiled about it.
Right.
But, you know, I think they do have the good continuity, and I'm a big continuity fan. They, you know, this is the same type of markings that happen on all those neutral zone type planets. So I was on board with the Borg right away.
Really? Even for the neutral zone?
Well, for the neutral zone, we didn't know who the Borg were at that time, right?
Right.
So, I still didn't think crystalline entity. I thought, I'll be honest, I thought they were introducing something that we weren't going to find out about. That it was kind of a build-up, kind of what we see in today's TV. Everything's so story-arced that they drop little snippets of information, and then, you know, 10 episodes later, they finally put it all together. And I think, again, Star Trek is always considered to be ahead of its time in many episodes. And I think this was, I don't think they necessarily knew it was going to be the Borg, but I think they had a feeling that this was going to be something, a new enemy that they were going to have. So
one thing I took away from the teaser, by the way, is that I think it's actually a very vanilla kind of teaser. It's almost it could have started any episode. And to be honest with you, I think that, you know, it's very similar to, frankly, the teaser from last week where they beamed down to a location and found something. But I think, Blair, you mentioned the music, and really, I don't know whether it's just because it's, you know, fantastically well scored, or whether it's because it's been uniquely scored in a different way compared to other episodes in this. But the first thing that you realize that's almost a sign that this is going to be special is the fact it's got this unique score going on. And, you know, the idea of people just meeting in the transporter room to beam down, it seems very, very regular. And even when they kind of pull back and they see that there's a big crater there, I think I seem to remember at the time thinking, okay, well, you know, it is one of these things of the week. And it's not, you know, you don't get any hint of it being the Borg until in Intel effectively, you know, after the teaser is done and then the Admiral comes on board and they start mentioning them by name. So I find it strange. It seems to open relatively small. And in fact, I think throughout the episode, they do build up, but what they want to do, they need to build up this tension of the Borg coming. And I like the way that they don't mention anyone by name during the teaser. They then do mention people by name, but they're uncertain. And then they start, it's only around halfway through the episode that effectively there's the quote unquote, we've engaged the Borg thing. And I think that the delay, the anticipation really adds to the atmosphere, in particular of the first episode. And the first episode is kind of all about the atmosphere of leading up to the confrontation.
Yes.
I'd also say too, James, that although vanilla, I agree the music certainly almost upped the stakes. But one thing I do notice with a lot of Star Trek episodes is anything that has a short teaser, it's almost as like, okay, let's just get the teaser out of the way because we have a jam-packed show. We're not going to do a 6 to 7 minute teaser. And I'm not sure how long it was, but it was probably less than a minute, maybe around there before we broke to the opening credits. And I sometimes find that those are the episodes where like, ooh, that's really quick. Okay. And let's get right back to the episode.
Yeah. They didn't have the B plot introducing, you know, this week Worf is going to go off to learn poetry with Geordi, kind of comedic scene.
I'd love to see that. Right, you're right. And some teasers are so long that you forgot it was actually just the teaser. You know, some DS9 does that as well. You know, 12 minutes into the episode, and then, but okay.
There isn't a 12-minute teaser, is there? I'd love to see the statistics on the longest teaser.
Are you saying I'm being sarcastic or something?
Well, I do know the shortest teaser was the...
from Enterprise, right? From Impulse.
Yes. Impulse, my favorite Enterprise episode by far.
Yeah, which is, I mean, so for anyone not aware, the teaser on that is T'Pol just screaming.
Oh, that's right. That's right. There you go. Thank you. Just
with the Vulcan zombies.
Yes.
Indeed.
I'm not too great on episode names. So, okay, well, then when we record... we were going to record Porthos. It was going to be called Porthos, a Enterprise podcast review. We'll bring you on for that one, Blair.
That sounds good.
Yes, we have Lower Pylon 2. I haven't figured... What did we decide for Voyager, Doc? The Caretaker's Array?
Oh, I don't quite know, but I would have thought that our Enterprise podcast would be called Girl on Girl on Man on Dog.
You're listening to Girl on Girl on Man on Dog.
The number of times we brought up that scene.
Oh, I know.
Just don't type that into Google or you could find yourself getting into a bit of trouble.
Yeah, do that on the virtual system if you're going to do that, okay? I have virtual XP that I actually use to test things out. And whenever I reboot it, Microsoft Steady State just reboots it to what it was before. And then I go on again. Never get a virus that way. So anyway, Admiral Hansen and Commander Shelby come aboard to discuss the Borg, and apparently Shelby has become some kind of an expert on this, on the Borg. Now, I'm curious what her credentials are. I mean, do you think maybe she, like, studied video of the Borg, or she just watched this episode over and over? Q-Who, right? Was it in Q-Who?
Yes.
Yeah, Q-Who.
Do you think she just watched that episode over and over and over again to become an expert on the Borg? Because we find out later everything she thinks she knows is wrong.
Well, that's really all she has to go off on, right? And they have to assign some senior officer. She's a command-level officer. She probably has a whole bunch of underlings around her, which that part kind of is, you know, a small little nitpick, is they only bring the one person on. She should have, would have been, you know, a little more credibility. Bring your team on. They don't have to have any speaking parts. But, she was probably senior officer assigned in it. She has a lot of technicians and engineers working under her. They report to her and they analyze, you know, phaser blasts and the hull being cut out and so on and so forth. So, but they just didn't have time to get into that. We had to take it at face value that she was the expert and go with it.
Mm-hmm. Every admiral's uncle had a take on this Borg business. But keep your eye on her. And I like the discussion. You seem a little taken with her, JP. Just an old man's fantasies.
Yeah, that was inappropriate.
Yeah, a little creepy.
Yeah.
I have to say, I absolutely love this Shelby character. And I think it makes total sense that she's on board the Enterprise. And you can imagine what happened. They came back with the logs from Q-Who, and it gets sent over to Command, and they sit there, and there's probably a lot of bureaucracy going on, and it sounds like this Shelby character kind of got her head down and started to do stuff. And I really like I think the performance of the character is great throughout the two episodes. Mm-hmm. And I like, in particular, we're going to go straight into these scenes with her headbutting with Riker and the way that she interacts with and how she fits into the crew. And I really like, I really like what they did here. And I remember, let me just put out there that I don't recall a gap when I watched part one and part two. So I didn't watch it as it was being aired. So I must have picked it up later or seen it on TV when the gap was no longer there. And I don't even know if there was a gap when they were broadcast in the UK. The back of my mind, I think that there was a gap in the sense that they got taken from terrestrial TV to pay TV, which I think might have annoyed more people. But I think, I don't know if that's something I'm just false remembering.
Oh, hold on, Doc. Before you go on further, I do have a cough, and I kind of coughed over you. I muted, but I missed some of what you said. And what do you mean by the gap?
The gap in airing between part one and part two of The Best of Both Worlds.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I see what you're saying.
The famous gap over summer, and I didn't experience that.
No, I suppose you wouldn't, because, yeah, it wasn't for a couple of years that you got it, but, yeah, there was a gap. It was a three, four-month traditional gap here. Because I remember living through it, because like I've said before, and I told this to Blair's crew, I recorded TNG not only on VHS but also on audio and listened to it in the pizza route. And I remember this cliffhanger and absolutely going crazy. I had to wait to see how this was going to end. But yeah, that's what we all went through here.
But the thing about the Shelby character, with regards to Shelby character, I thought that she was being brought in. I thought that she was so kind of well-rounded and so well-written. I was absolutely convinced that they were just bringing her in and replacing someone on the show. So I was, watching this as a child, I thought that either Riker was on his way out because Riker's boring, and I really hated Riker at this point, or Picard was on his way out because actually, frankly, I was also not that keen on Picard either. So either it was going to be, promote Riker up and bring Shelby in, or Riker goes on his own way and brings Shelby in. But I remember watching this, and I just loved the Shelby character, and it was so clear to me that this was a real well thought through three-dimensional character that was properly interacting with the team and frankly was written better than your average guest star role. I thought that it was very obvious that this was a new person coming onto the regular cast.
It's funny you say that, James, because I didn't realize at the time that Patrick Stewart was in contract negotiations and may not have been returning. And I guess, the internet wasn't really around or wasn't around back then. I could only imagine the speculation nowadays if we had that. But I honestly thought it was going to be Riker that was going to be replaced. He was never a big fan of me or a fan of mine. I must admit, after this episode, I liked him more. But I just found he was, he was just there. But you say you really liked her. See, I couldn't stand her. But at the same token, I do think she was well written, but I did not like her. And I'll talk more about that as we go through the episode on reasons why. But she absolutely drove me nuts.
Oh, I agree.
And glad to see her go.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with Blair. She just rubbed me the wrong way as well. She buttoned up against Riker for no other reason. And it seemed like she just couldn't keep her mouth shut. I intend to convince Captain Picard that I'm the right person for the job. Job? What job? Well, yours, of course. I mean, it just seemed like she kept inserting her foot every time she opened her mouth.
Yeah, that, and I was going to mention it later, but since you brought it up, Lou, that, I think that irritates me more. And you know, in the real world, if anyone was putting their, you know, that forward with, I just want a better job, you know, as opposed to, hey, this is humanity at stake here. And you're more worried about your career. Why don't you worry about your career later and let's get this job fixed? But she seemed way too focused on becoming a first officer. Mm-hmm. I don't know how long she'd been a lieutenant commander for, but that really irritated me. It should have been obvious. Yeah, she knows her stuff and maybe she does have the protection of an admiral. And, you know, you see that all the time. People get a little more confident when they know that they're not going to be chastised or get in trouble for it when they're protected. But I thought that was a little way too over the top of all she wanted was that position. Listen, you've got a job to do. If you do a good job, good things will happen in the end.
Yeah, it just seemed like her main role was to piss off Riker. So, all right. So even Hansen tries to convince Picard that she'd make one hell of a first officer, but he already has a hell of a first officer. Oh, no, don't tell me he's going to pass up another commission. The Melbourne, it's his if he wants it. So how many does that make? And I admittedly, I had to use Google to really get this. But we start with the Drake. He was offered the Drake, but he gave it up to become first officer in the Enterprise. Then we have the Ares when Daddy came to visit. And now the Melbourne. Did I miss anything? We're not talking about future stuff, just up to this point.
I think it's three. I think it's three up to this point.
Okay.
And actually, I have to say that I'm not the biggest Riker fan up until this episode. I think this episode's a great and the B plot. Maybe it's not even the B plot, right? But the stuff around Riker and the command, and then how he has to step into Picard's role as after Picard gets abducted and whatnot. I think it really is fantastic. And I also think it gives a legitimate reason for Riker to stay as first officer. I think that his character goes throughout this episode, he goes through a big growth arc. And I think that he just learns, what he wants to do and where he wants to be. And often whenever I will criticize, Star Trek with, hey, 7 years later or 10 years later or 15 years later, if you count the films, everyone's in the same position. No one's, no one's married. No one's had kids. Everyone's in the same job, probably on the same salary. It's a little bit unrealistic. I think that this is really the episode that kind of really gives you a glimpse into Riker's personality and the reasons why he is there.
Hmm. Whereas I was thinking more like just the opposite of Shelby, her ambition is to become first officer someday of that ship. His is he's looking at the bigger picture. He wants to protect the Federation first before he does any of that, and he's comfortable there. And also, even when it comes time in the next episode, we'll glance ahead for promotion time. I thought he was completely wrong to make Shelby first officer and not Data, but what he says makes sense. This is not the time for change. This, we can't worry about our own ambition. We got to worry about the Federation. So this is, I need you where Captain Picard relied on you.
And I have lots of notes on that too, Lou, because I disagreed with the situation. I still don't think it makes sense, but we'll get to that in the next episode. And that's the thing with this episode. It's so good that we're combining two episodes together and just talking about the show as a whole, because it is a very seamless transition and there's just so much to talk about.
Does that mean you want to come on for the next one? You promise?
I promise, yes.
Okay, I'll hold you to that. However, let's go back to Captain Riker, or the potential Captain Riker. Actually, if you think about it, he was captain at one time. He had the USS Hathaway as they were doing a battle simulation with the Enterprise in peak performance. And we know he becomes captain in the second part of this episode. But later he becomes captain again on the USS Excalibur. Remember where they were trying to expose Romulan interference in the Klingon Civil War? And he finally accepts being captain of the Titan in Insurrection. So Riker has promotions coming ahead. Okay.
Was that Insurrection, Lou? It was the final. I can't even think of what the final one was. No, it's Nemesis.
Nemesis. Oh, did I say Insurrection?
Yes.
And I have Insurrection there. Oh, thanks, Doc. You corrected me on Skype. That's very sweet. You could chime in and say Nemesis. So that's staying in because I love when I make those kind of mistakes. But unless you guys have anything more on this, we could talk about Riker escorting Shelby to her quarters and what we missed. Do you want to discuss it?
Sure.
Doc?
So, what do you mean, what we missed?
He didn't hit on her.
Now, that's one thing that I never noticed at the time.
Yeah.
But when you do look at this episode and you do see this, you know, strong female character coming on to the show, and she's not here as to be hit on either by Riker or by Worf or by Picard, I think it's unfortunately relatively rare that happens on Trek.
Yes. Would you?
So your assertion here that maybe they got up to something while the after the poker game will be. I will try to rebut that.
No, it wasn't after the poker game, but I mean, he brought her to her quarters and didn't offer to wash her feet. Something.
You don't hit on somebody you don't like, though. And if I was Riker, this character was, as I said, was very unlikable. So, nope. In you go. See you later. Close the door. See you tomorrow.
Or maybe he tried until she mentioned how she's after his job. You know, I was going to hit on you. But you're a bitch now. I got to go. Bye. Or maybe it was late for the poker night. Oh, no, she did join him for the poker game, didn't she?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, the poker game. LaForge, he folds quickly, doesn't he?
He always folds quickly.
He folds quickly. If he can't get a little action, he just leaves and cries. And after a little pressure, Wesley folds.
And why is Wesley there? And this episode is so great. And I just, little small nitpicks, a junior officer should not be at that poker table. The amount of flack and resentment he would get from other junior officers for hanging out with the, you know, bootlicking those senior officers' feet. Riker doesn't need to get his feet washed. Wesley's doing it for him with all the bootlicking.
Oh, yeah. You know,
to get invited to that senior poker table.
So you think Wesley's social standing is damaged, what, beyond being completely at zero, I suppose? I just think there's no further that Wesley can't sink any lower amongst the standard in other junior officers. Certainly not since he got promoted to, like, you know, full lieutenant, or, you know, rather than full lieutenant. What am I talking about? The full ensign. Full ensign rather than acting ensign.
Here, hold on. I'm going to help you here.
Ensign.
Okay, go on. Yeah,
thanks. I've got that in the chat. The reason why I said the nemesis in the chat a little while ago is that I had to mute myself because one of these kids was being taken upstairs to bed and was screaming.
Oh, I love hearing your kids. I'm going to bed now, Papa. Anyway, I'm sorry. That was completely uncalled for. Go on.
But could you imagine if you were at work and some new employee came in and he's having lunch with the boss and sitting at the table and he's being invited over for dinner, and here you are, maybe been on that ship for a few years, you've been with your employment for 10 years or so, and you've never once been invited to the poker game. But, you know, once again, it's the old nepotism, because this is his mom must be having something with Captain, or not Picard, because he never goes, but you know what I'm saying? I don't know. But anyway, it's a small thing.
Well,
but
his dad is captain of the ship, let's face it. Go on.
I knew you were going to say that.
Of course you did. My dad's captain. All right. Well, so the next morning on a poker... Oh, so anyway, I can't do that just yet. So Wesley does fold. Shelby's in for the long haul, but we don't get to see Data bend. Now, I don't know how to play poker. I got to tell you guys this. But just because Shelby tossed in 20 or 10 and says, I got to see your hold card, couldn't Worf jump in at this point and say, I raise your 10 and another 50? Or what determines the end of the game?
Well, I'm not a poker player, but from what I understand, Riker would have had to have seen that 10. But I can't remember if Worf already bet at that point.
I didn't think he did, and it just, I don't know. It seems to me, if you don't fold, everybody keeps going, well, I'll raise your 10. No, I'll raise your 20. No, I'll raise you 50. No, I'll raise you 100. It's either go like that, fold, or we call and put our cards down.
You can just not bet anything, and then everyone doesn't bet anything either, and then everyone shows their hands. But if someone raises it, in order to stay in the game, everyone has to at least match that bet. But they have the opportunity while matching to raise it. If they don't raise it, they just meet the bet, and that's fine.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I thought as well. So who do we believe was still in the game at this point? Because I thought it was only Shelby and Riker.
Yeah, I thought Worf was out. I thought Worf was out, but I can't remember now.
I feel bad.
But by the way, I wrote down a few sentences about the poker game, because the whole point of the poker game, right, is that it's just showing you that, you know, Riker is very comfortable amongst his own crew, and Shelby comes on board, and Shelby is after Riker, and she's a risk taker, and she's not going to allow Riker to get away with things, and she's also, you know, in the end, she ends up beating Riker.
Yeah.
And I think that's really the way that they want to position the Riker-Shelby relationship.
Hmm.
So that's really the only point.
But I think that's a good relationship because, you know, I know in my career, you know, when you're younger, you're full of pee and vinegar and you're ready to go and you're doing things. But as you get older and have more responsibilities, whether you become a supervisor or management, all of a sudden things that maybe you did in the past, looking back, you probably maybe wouldn't have done that again. But so I do like that kind of dynamic between Riker is basically looking at himself, mm-hmm. you know, in Shelby.
Absolutely. And I think it's an absolute it's a valid dynamic for there to be. In the same way that when we get to like Lower Decks and there's the pseudo Riker Jr. dude, and the way that his interaction with Riker is one where, you know, it's a valid and it's a legitimate way of looking at these very eager guys coming through and wanting to impress and wanting to make, go up the career ladder as fast as they can.
And I think this is the first time as well, outside of Riker being offered promotions where he's always turned them down, but this is the first time we see somebody actually, hey, I want to do well in my career. You never really saw LaForge or Worf. They were just doing their job. This is somebody who's outwardly making an effort. And correct me if I'm wrong, but it's really the first real conflict we have between Starfleet officers themselves, unless they're corrupt Starfleet officers. I'm talking about the normal, well-intended officers. There's some pretty harsh, he doesn't like her and she doesn't like him. And that's more real world.
Yep, I think that's a very valid point. And you did put the word there, well-intentioned Starfleet officers, which obviously is going to allow us to bypass the Pulaski data access with that horrible, nasty, racist woman. but the thing that I also point out is that Riker's not used to having someone pushing up from below, in the sense that, you know, the next guy in charge would be Data. Well, Data's just a competent dude that's going to sit there for 25 years and not complain about any pension pay rise or anything. You know, Worf is very honorable and the like. He doesn't sound like he's going to be going after anyone's job. So, you know, in a way, this kind of friction with Shelby is completely new.
And did I say Worf was in the poker game? If I did, I was totally wrong. I was just watching it.
Is he not even there?
No, he's not even there. Riker, from Riker's left, it's Troy, Data, LaForge, Crusher, and Shelby. And it looks like everybody was in. LaForge goes out quick, then Crusher, and then it seems like Shelby just takes the spot. She wins. So
I guess Worf's too busy preparing for the battle that's ahead, but everyone else has a bit of time to play poker, and I guess.
Or it had been too close. Got to get a bigger table. Okay, so. But what is Sam Lavelle about? I have to ask.
Oh, Sam Lavelle's the junior officer that in Lower Decks that James was referring to.
Oh.
He's the Riker.
Yeah, ever since I sent over the Nemesis comment, and you and now Blair have tried to send me comments to fudge my memory when you had your Nemesis fail earlier on in the episode.
That's funny.
But I'm now calling a truce on this.
Oh, Doc, okay. Doc, you really must go on Upper Pylon too. Then they are a blast when they the behind the scene things, like when a clip is playing. Those are exciting. You're missing out. Okay. So, Shelby wins the pot. And the next morning on a poker hangover, after losing his shirt, his pants, and even his drawers, Riker and LaForge beam down to the planet without Shelby and Data. Why? Because they beamed down earlier, an hour earlier, and that just pisses off Riker. So,
I have to say, sorry, just one slight nitpick. So Riker and Geordi walk in to the transporter room, and immediately they appear to be tardy. Mm-hmm. I mean, what, like 30 seconds tardy, or maybe even less? I think maybe they're trying to show that he's slightly, you know, ruffled by Shelby being there, and he's kind of pulling her up at every opportunity. Mm-hmm. But it seemed a little unfair, right?
Right.
Well, I think it's the old, you want my job, you should have been here before me. I'm showing up, and I'm now waiting on you.
Hmm.
You think you can be first officer? Well, if I was in your shoes, I would have been here 10 minutes before I arrived. And that's kind of how I took that.
Yeah, that's a good point. I get him to work in the morning. The guy comes in next to me, and you know, and a minute and a half later, and is, what time do you call this?
So then how should that scene have gone? Okay, they walk in and says, Data and our guests appear to be tardy. So, O'Brien, how's Keiko been? Are you guys considering getting married someday? Or while we wait for Data and Shelby, why don't we discuss what's happening in your life lately? You guys are stunned with that. I'm going to go on.
No, I'm just really looking forward, because we're now about to start season four. Keiko is in season four. I believe I'm the only person in the world that likes Keiko. If there's a Keiko-centric DS9 episode coming up soon, I'm happy to be brought on to Upper Pylon 2.
Give it to him. Give it to him.
We do have a couple of good Keiko lovers on the show, so I'll take a look ahead and see what we have for you.
Do that.
There's absolutely nothing wrong with Keiko at all. She is... wonderful. I mean, O'Brien's punching well above his weight with Keiko. Let me tell you that.
What? Oh, come on.
Oh, Miles.
I was going to say, you need to get a clip of her and just play it over and over of her saying, Miles.
Miles, Miles, Miles. Okay. So anyway, no, she ain't bad in TNG, because we only see her, what, once or twice? Anyway. I have good news. Keiko has made a decision designed to increase her happiness. She's canceled the wedding. What? Great! That's wonderful! Never mind. So, the only thing it seems Riker is mad about is that he wants to be notified if there's a change in his orders. Not that, you know, she changed the orders at all, that he wants to be notified.
I think this interaction on the planet is very good, because I think, I mean, actually, as Blair was mentioned, I think you've got two people coming from well-intentioned directions. You have Riker, who's used to the ship and the protocol and the way things are done, and basically people following his orders. And at the same time, you've got Shelby, who's not from the ship, doesn't really appreciate the full protocol of being out in the field. Perhaps she's also been flagged as someone who's been given a wide berth, because it she gets things done and she makes things happen. So I think it's very in her character to have done this, not to spite Riker, but just because it was, you know, she's let off the leash in order to achieve things and get the work done. And I think they're both right. So from Riker's perspective, it's there could have been problems, and there's a reason why the chain of command and the protocol exists. And from Shelby's perspective, she's been rewarded and allowed to go slightly outside of this tighter defined role, and they end up I think it's just a legitimate two people knocking heads that are trying to do their best.
Really? Because I took it as she doesn't need Riker. There'd be no reason why she doesn't call him up and say, there's a storm front moving in. I recommend we go a little early. Yes, sir. No, sir. Okay, sir. Whatever his decision is. Especially Data. Why did he just go along with it? This is not what we were told to do. But she wanted to prove she didn't need Riker. Early bird gets the worm. Right.
Well, it's the old, she knew if she asked, he would say no.
Right.
So it's easier to beg for forgiveness. And I think, and again, this is another dynamic here, is Shelby does not fall under his chain of command. He is not in charge of Shelby. Hmm. She reports to the Admiral. She does not report to Riker. So she knows she's protected. Riker knows she's protected. What's he going to do? He writes a complaint to the Admiral or puts it to Picard, who gives it to the Admiral and says, oh, Shelby went early. The Admiral's going to say, really? Stop dinking around here. Put your pride aside and just get the job done. She knows that. He knows that. And I think that's why, and again, skipping ahead to part two, the look on her face when the Admiral says to Riker, you're captain now, is just priceless. Mm. Because now she knows, she's like, ah, crap, I'm now going to have to report to him. Damn it.
Right. I wanted to be first officer, but not under him.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, good point. Okay, so later, so they did determine the resonance frequency is the exact same as when they faced him at J25. It no doubt any longer. It is the Borg. Good so far, everyone?
It's all good. Yeah. It's all good. And I mean, as I was mentioning towards the beginning, this is part of the extended, drawing out the build-up, right, the anticipation in this episode. And it's and I think it's all the better for it.
Yes. So Admiral Hansen decided to go off and meet with Starfleet and plan of attack. But in the meantime, we need to discuss Commander Riker. What do you think of Shelby? Well, she's a bitch. She knows her stuff. That's what he meant was by she knows her stuff, is she's a cocky bitch. And Picard says she reminds him of a young lieutenant commander that he recruited as a first officer. And I was thinking about that. Are we sure about that? And I may have... Hold on. Yeah. No, I didn't skip ahead. Okay. Wasn't Riker a first officer before? Because he refused to let Captain Gleason beam down to a planet because it was too dangerous?
Yep, but you can be a first officer and be a lieutenant or a lieutenant commander. You don't have to be a commander to be a first officer, just like you don't have to be a captain to be a captain of the ship.
So Riker was lieutenant commander prior to encounter at Farpoint, I believe.
Yes.
And then he got promoted to commander as he was being promoted up to up to serve on the Enterprise.
Mm-hmm. But he could have been a first officer on smaller ships, but now it's the flagship. So now, this is the flagship. Here's your Commander Pip, and you can be a first officer on a much bigger ship now.
Mm. Well, that makes more sense then, because I thought, well, maybe there was a continuity glitch, but he refused to let Captain Gleason. Was it Captain Gleason? Did I get that right?
I thought it was DeSoto. Yeah.
Captain DeSoto? Okay.
I wasn't going to put anything in the Skype chat.
I'll do it. DeSoto.
Yeah, there we go.
There we go. Okay, so who was I remember now. Captain Gleason was the one who buttered their bread a little bit for Barclay.
Oh, yes, you're right.
There we go. Guys, I like it when
I thought Gleason was the guy we're seeing in the next episode, but maybe that's his son.
Oh man, this is crazy. You've just got enough doubt. So I'm going to pull up part two's intro. And you're right, Todd Morell is Gleason. Mm-hmm. Oh man. Okay, as we're talking, I'm going to look that up. So anyway, let's go on. Let's see, before we get to the Borg, you know, okay, there was a thing in 10 Ford where Riker was talking to Troy about, why am I here? Why am I still here? Why don't I go on? And did you notice that the pyramid game on top of the table?
I missed that. I didn't.
Well, in later episodes, you see a little black pyramid, like a game on top of every table in 10 Ford. And I think this is the first time we actually see that pyramid game. But I was thinking, just imagine if they were on the tables during Sarek when the one guy got flipped onto the table.
Slammed through a table.
Yeah, well, he was slammed through a table. But imagine if that was on the table at the time. Gosh darn it, that would have hurt.
I'm actually just trying to find the scene now because I do not have a mental memory of a pyramid game.
No?
You're talking about that. Is it a game or it just looks like an ornament?
No, I think it's some kind of game that they could play. It had buttons on it. Let me try and I'm going to try to find it.
Maybe it's a candle. Yeah, an illumination on for the a table dressing.
Hmm.
But actually, by the way, I'm actually a really big fan of this particular interaction between Riker and Troy. I think it's actually very good. I think it's very it's a very honest discussion, and I do like the way that like Riker kind of puts all of this out. He like admits that there are certain qualities about Shelby that he likes and he doesn't, and where they went. And even the, you know, even when Troy tries to reassure him, saying he's now more seasoned, and he's like, seasoned. So that's a horrible thing to say to a man. I fear that I'm going through a similar phase as Riker is at this point in time. And certainly this idea about being, you know, Troy says that she doesn't understand, but I completely understand this idea of being, quote, too comfortable in a position.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's very natural. I think you get to the point where you perhaps would, you know, go off and seek new challenges, but you're very comfortable in your current surroundings. And you know, I very much relate to Riker on this front.
Hmm. Okay, try if you're looking at the video, try 13:41 into it. They are in there 10 forward where they're discussing the comfortable here. But you got to figure it's a nice ship. How many Starfleet ships have holodecks, gymnasiums, phaser ranges? And it is a comfortable ship. He's got a good job. But like Picard also says, he's got a net. He's just responsible enough, but ultimately not responsible. So, okay, so I noticed a little unprofessionalism in Riker again this week when him and Shelby are having a discussion in 10 Ford. It's time to get some rest. Well, if I could work with Data, who does not require rest? You need rest. And when she walks off, he does that. I don't know if you guys notice that glance he does to Geordi or Data. Ugh. I'm getting
But it's so natural, though. Yeah. And I like to see that, though,
yeah,
that there is this conflict. And he's looking at his friends going, oh, my God, do you see what I have to put up with right now? I can't stand working with her, and I have no choice. And yeah, that's so real world. How many of us work with people that at times you just feel like throttling them because they're not, you know, they're not being a team player. They're doing what they want to do. And there's a process to follow, and she certainly isn't following it.
Right.
And relating, I think a lot of people can relate this into the real world, this scene in particular in engineering, where, you know, people are pulling all nighters to get something done and now going through things. You know, this seems very good because you know that the crew are running out of time. So you've still got this hype of the Borg that coming, and you know the weapon systems are 24 months away, and you know, what can you do about it? And there's lots of ideas, but nothing is quite focused, and you know people are tired. And then you know Riker, I think he correctly pulls everyone out and needs for people to get sleep.
Yeah,
and you then have this overlay of the Shelby confrontation. I think this stuff is really great, and it's, in a way, you might suggest, or you know. If you were a moron, you might suggest that for a big action show like Best of Both Worlds, although truth be told, there's not a huge amount of action in it when you compare it to something that is at the end of DS9, for example. Mm. But for a huge action show, we haven't scenes of people sitting down and discussing their career. We haven't scenes about people sitting down and theorizing about the best way of, you know, doing some bitchy-majig on their shields. But the reason why it works is that it's really building up to this still unseen enemy at this point that they are coming. And I think that's one thing this episode just does fantastically well. When you compare it to other episodes of the Borg, when you really have to show the Borg first thing attacking people in order to get any tension. Whereas here we've got an episode which is, you know, dialed up to 11 on tension already, and we've not seen a single one of the enemy. And I think it's really perfectly executed for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was 18 minutes before the Borg were even on the view screen. But, okay. So the USS Lalo was the first ship to encounter the Borg. It identified as cube-shaped. And we'll be there in less than an hour. So what do you think? And I even put in here, number 12 says the music is terrific during this encounter. And I hold this to the level of The Defector. And if you remember, I really praised the music in The Defector, the buildup of the sound. And this is another one. It draws you in to the drama as it builds up.
Lou, you talk about the bit where we've now got the Borg cube on the screen.
Yes.
And how that's built in. Yes. Because another clever thing that they did, I didn't, you know, you generally don't necessarily notice these things, but so what they had as well is that they had the picture of the Borg cube and then they zoomed in and then they left this kind of very large zoomed in picture of the Borg. And by the time the music had built up, the Borg cube was so large that it didn't actually fit onto the view screen. Mm. And it's again a very powerful sign that you're running into an enemy that, frankly, you might not be able to overcome. So just these, you know, the build-up of the music, the build-up symbolism of the view screen, all of this is really pitting, you know, the little mouse against the dragon here.
Well, absolutely, because you remember Q Who, where the Enterprise limped home. If it hadn't been for Q sending them back, they were done. The Enterprise was done. The thing ripped out three decks of its saucer section. It was done. And now, here they are. So you're right, the drama and the buildup was awesome.
Yeah, and I know I was on your show for Q-Who, and that's kind of why I asked for this episode. And at the end of Q-Who, we knew they were coming. Well, this is it. They're here now. And there's no Q here to save them, so how are they going to get out of this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Yeah, phasers and photon torpedoes. All right. So the Borg hails the Enterprise, and not just the ship. They want Picard by name because they want him to beam over. Beam on over and come talk to us. But when he doesn't, that's when they lock a tractor beam on and start cutting into the hull. So what do you think of Shelby's fluctuate phaser frequencies? You know, don't give him a chance to adapt.
I think it's good. In watching this again this week, I guess this is probably, for the time, I was a young kid. This was amazing. This was so exciting. Mm-hmm. But you look at DS9 CGI battles. This was very static. You know, there was no movement. They sat there. Well, I know they were in the tractor beam, but, you know, it just still it, at the time, it was so exciting. Like, holy cow, here they go again. They're losing, you know, engineering. They've just lost a whole bunch of people. You know, Shelby's idea was great because we continuity wise, this is something that continued on throughout the series about changing, you know, frequencies, don't let them adapt. So I do like that idea. And I guess I must have saw the HD version this week. And you actually see the in the phaser blasts, the different colors. So I thought that was kind of neat because you didn't see that originally in the I have an old copy of the version. I know it wasn't on there, but I you know, was streaming it this week and saw the HD version, and it was much more detailed. So that was kind of cool.
You're right. And you referenced DS9, and you're right. I love being mounted on top of the Defiant as it's in some of those battles, and the way they maneuver while they're firing was awesome. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And you don't get that.
Yeah, exactly. You don't get that here. And
I'm going to have to jump in though, just to make it clear about I'm going to defend Best of Both Worlds, and also not necessarily just Best of Both Worlds, but other episodes that are kind of quote action packed whilst actually frankly nothing is happening, because you know, there are many ways to convey the you know, the action of the scene and the tension of the scene. And I do accept that when you look at Best of Both Worlds, fundamentally what you have is you've got, you know, the Cube and the Enterprise sitting next to each other having a bit of a phaser fight for, you know, for seconds, frankly. You've then got reports over the comm about the fight. You've then got the graveyard in the second part. And you've got a couple of other pretty static encounters. And I think a good question to ask is that, well, why does it still feel so, you know, so action-packed, so tense? So why are you so engaged? And I think that there is limitation of the effects here, certainly compared to today's standard, but I think that's more of it's more of the indication that what you're being drawn into, or the reason why you're being drawn into this kind of like action scene, is not really anything to do with or not as much at least to do with the special effects. It's all to do with the storytelling that has taken place, and the fact that you're on the edge of your seat while Shelby kind of walks up at a flat angle to talk to Data to tell him to do something, and then a flat angled shot of a couple of phasers. It's the reason why you're involved is because of the characters and the story that's been developed. And I think that I'm not going to ever say that on DS9 they don't do that. They still have the story, but I think it's a great acknowledgement at least to make that with the Best of Both Worlds and other Star Trek episodes, they managed to keep this they managed to keep this involvement despite very limited effects and despite very limited, production values when you compare it to like an action film.
Yeah, I think you make a great point, James. And that's the difference, is sometimes you can have really action-packed shows with no substance to it. And I think this, as you said, there isn't a lot of action in this. It's really one little battle scene and a couple chase scenes. But the build up, you're on the seat you're on this edge of your seat, really looking forward to what's going to happen, and that's because they've taken the time to build it up, and I think they do a really good job of it.
Yep,
I think Nu and I spoke, you know, at the beginning of the season when we did the Wrath of Khan. The Wrath of Khan does not have action scenes that anyone that's under the age of 30 would recognize as an action scene. But you're still invested in this, for want of a better word, action scene. I think it's just that, you know, there were shortcomings that needed to be overcome. And then you have to focus on what you can, you know, I think this episode, you're focusing on what's important, and you have to make the Borg seem unstoppable without them going through and destroying planets and, you know, and blowing up holes in the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they just achieve it very well. Let me just say one thing, though. They have this, something I only noticed today, which is that there's a point where Riker where the Borg are trying to get through the shields, and Riker makes a flippant comment saying, you know, Commander, they do have the ability to analyze and adapt. Mm. And I had never noticed that if you look at Shelby when he says that, she turns to Riker and gives him like the nastiest stare in the world until they get hit again. So she's like sitting there basically saying, you know, do you not, you know, I've been working with the Borg for the last year and a half. Really, you're telling me that they've got the ability to adapt. I'm not a moron. And I quite like that. We mentioned before that Riker had this sidelong glance at, you know, at Shelby, but it's both ways throughout this episode.
I missed that side, that glance, James. Actually, what I just took it as was this was a way for new viewers to be reminded or to be instructed that, hey, they can adapt. But I think that's an excellent point. I totally missed that.
Oh, yeah, I noticed the glare.
No, it is definitely there, but I had never seen it. I didn't see it before. And yeah, it's in a way, right, you're achieving two things. You are achieving exposition, but you also achieve an exposition through this interaction that you already know exists and a condescending nature between the two of them. So it's kind of, well, hey, someone might have thought that someone very competent had written this show. And I think that the writing throughout is just fantastic. And, you know, all of these bits and pieces just add up to this, a much richer, a much, you know, a very deep show that we can love 30 years down the line.
Right. But what's weird about that argument, though, well, it's really an argument, she says the nutation modulation has them confused. Why wouldn't she know that they have the ability to adapt?
Well, she doesn't know.
Right. Okay, so, but she's just pointing it out. Okay, they're a little confused right now. So who was being the jerk in this argument, Riker or her? To me... No,
Riker was being the jerk.
Right.
So she basically just said that, you know, the precaution that we had with the shields are keeping them busy for a while. Mm-hmm. And then Riker basically said, hey, yeah, but you do realize that it's not going to keep them busy forever. And I think that was basically the discussion that was taking place.
Yes.
So I thought that Riker was being a bit of a jerk.
It's a good thing Picard didn't have to say, all right, later, children.
Children, calm down.
Yeah, calm down, children. You go to your
corner. That was one thing you didn't see, though, right? And it would have been interesting to see Picard having to be the middleman.
Mm.
But you didn't really get to see a lot of that because, you know, Shelby was smart. She wasn't doing it in front of Picard very often, right? And you're right. Riker looked like the idiot here, and Shelby's probably laughing inside.
There you go. Good point. But they go ahead.
You're assuming in that case it's manipulative. And I know that you can read the Shelby character in different ways. And in particular, there's a part in the second part of this episode where you do think, actually, she must have been planning a lot of this. She's, you know, she is manipulating the situation. But I think I'm more generous to the Shelby character. And I don't quite see her as manipulating and laughing inside when she manages to get one up on Riker. I do see it is that there are these two good people that are clashing. And they're trying to do their best. And in this particular case, I think, you know, Riker was a little bit too pedantic and, was abrasive. But you can certainly read it both ways. And I know, and I'm sure other people would have seen this Shelby character coming in and, you know, upsetting the apple cart and, you know, not liking it because it's an external force shaking things up.
And I think I would agree, except if she wasn't throwing it the I want your job thing in your face, and then I could totally see how, that it's two good people just, you know, trying to do a good job and who just don't laugh at the same jokes. But because she is a very I want your job, blah, 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 that's why I think she's a little underhanded and a little, oh, look at me. Look who did that great job over there. You know, the guy that work that always makes sure goes out of his way to point out the job that he or she may not have done even, but you know, is taking full credit for it. And that's kind of how, you know, I think she's very manipulative. And, yeah.
Actually, I hear you on this. I've got a point in like two lines from now in my notes, but I'll raise it now, which is that you just remind me of, you know, as you think that she's kind of being very much an exhibitionist here in terms of, look at me, I'm doing all this smart stuff. there's a bit where after the battle, she, as they're heading off to the Nebula, she ends up at the front of the bridge, and Picard walks up to the front of the bridge and basically pulls her back. And it's there's no words exchanged. It's just a you know, tap on the shoulder. Shelby, I now want to be here in order to think about what I'm going to do as captain of this ship. And yeah. Shelby was in that space. And you think, actually, why is she in this space? She was taking control of the situation. She's ended up effectively above her station. Yeah. So I do see that slight exhibitionist tendency. But I thought that kind of nod was really subtly done within this episode. I think it's all so good, this.
Not only
that. And it was great. I think that was a very telling scene, and it would have been interesting if Riker had been the one to do that, if she would have just shrugged his arm off and stayed where she was. But it almost was, like you said, Captain Picard came in, hey, I'm regaining control here. Even her facial expression, she kind of put her head down and, just, okay, yeah, I'm submissive. You're the boss here, and step back. Yeah, that's a great point.
But the incredible thing is, this is nothing more than like 5-6 seconds of the episode where no dialogue happens. It's a glance between characters, but it tells you so much about the characters involved and their relative positions, and you know, and who's got the up, you know, who's coming up and who's kind of out of their depth. And I just, you know, it's just such a good scene. And you know, I have to say, I say this too often, but this shows you when this stuff kind of comes together like this, you really see that the director and then the actors and the writers, they must be all firing on all cylinders together, because you wouldn't get things like this come out unless they were all in the same direction, really, and very strongly, synchronously pushing in the same direction.
You notice that glance, James. That's good, because I noticed it too. But did you also notice the cocky look she has when the tractor beam is broken? She has a look of, yeah.
Riker almost never, a smirk.
A smirk is exactly right. Riker never would have came up with that. And then as soon as they warp 9 toward the pulse of Nebula, that's when Picard comes up and taps her and says, you're in my spot, lady.
The one thing I think would have been nice to see, and we did see it a bit with Troy, but I would have liked to have seen a little more uncomfortableness amongst the characters. I guess you did see it a bit with Geordi saying, yeah, she erred, going back to that away mission. But it would have been neat to see a little bit of side discussion with those guys, like Worf and LaForge looking at each other going, holy crap, Riker screwed up there. Like, geez, what, he should have listened to her, or vice versa. Man, that Shelby just is relentless, is not giving Riker a chance. But, and I know we're limited on time, but that would have been just an extra little added conflict in the episode that I think really would have, made it real world again, of everyone chooses sides in a conflict between coworkers. Right. And sometimes it's not that easy a decision who to choose sides with. And you can hurt feelings if you're perceived to have chosen the wrong side.
Right. Well, we better go on. We're only halfway through this at this point.
But before we go on, I have to ask a single question, which is this the first Geordi role?
Is it the first, sorry?
Geordi role in engineering as they're shutting it down.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No, wasn't it in yesterday's Enterprise? Didn't he do that?
Yeah.
When the ship was... Yeah.
Okay.
That's right.
No, you might be right.
You know, he is.
Parallel Geordi doesn't count as Geordi.
Oh, yes, he does. Because it wasn't parallel. It actually happened. And then, the reset button was hit. Voyager's reset button was hit. Voyager's great at that. LaForge and Crusher come up with a plan to use a deflector dish to destroy the Borg. Now, during this scene, did you notice Picard's chair was empty? I mean, it seemed very noticeable. I didn't notice it before until I did a review today. It was very noticeable that Picard's chair was empty. He was absent from this meeting about the plan of attack when they were, what are we going to do? Well, the deflector dish, it puts out more power than anything our phasers could ever do, as long as we use our warp power to do it. And that's when she comes up with another plan to separate the saucer section. Oh, no, shut up. I like the other guy's stuff first. And so Picard was not there. So let's flash forward a little bit to the next the next episode, okay? The follow-up. The deflector dish doesn't work. Do you think...
Spoilers?
Oh, please. This is a 30-year-old show. Do you think it's because how... Because after that scene, she goes run into Picard. He won't listen to me. I want to separate the saucer section and do this. And he's a jerk. Do you think maybe she tells him about the deflector dish as well?
Absolutely.
She had to. They said, let's use a deflector dish. I said, let's do the saucer separation. Which do you think is right? And that's when he walks in on them.
Mm-hmm. But again, I think that's, you know, you said the empty seat. I think that's so true to real life, though, that the boss doesn't have to be in every discussion. And I know it sets it up for later about, you know, Shelby going over his head, but it's a group of people, department heads, talking about options. They're presenting it to Riker. He's going to be the guy to go to Captain Picard with what he thinks is, here's option A, B, C, and D. I think we should go with option A. Picard would say, okay, A it is. Mm-hmm. And I like that. But, you know, if anything, we should have probably seen a little more of that throughout TNG. It seemed like Picard was involved in every discussion.
Right.
But in reality, it should have been, you know, we saw it down in engineering. Picard wasn't there either.
Mm-hmm.
It was Riker coming in, checking up on an update, LaForge with all his engineering guys. And I like that. But it certainly sets up one of my most favorite lines in all of Star Trek ever, and we'll get to that.
What?
Shortly.
You went over my helmet? Well, not exactly over, sir. More to the side. I'll always call you first. It'll never happen again. Never, ever. Oh, shit. No. Please. No, not that.
Yes, that.
Whoa!
Luke, can I just get some clarification on you? Are you suggesting that it's Shelby's fault that Picard knew of the deflector dish man? Or because I always felt that I didn't think that he learned it during that particular phase. I thought that he was just briefed about it on another occasion.
Really? Because it seemed to be it was too quick that he was abducted after that. I don't know.
Well, they went into that pulsar and hid in there. Nebula. And yeah. The nebula. And I think they were preparing Riker's plan or whoever's plan it was in the end for the deflector dish. So I think maybe he initially could have been told from Shelby, but I think either way, he certainly knew with all the planning, they were buying time hiding in that nebula, hoping that, their plan would have time to get ready. I was really hoping you could just put that Riker line in. That has got to be one of my most favoritest lines in all of Trek. You go over my head like that again.
You disagree with me, fine. You need to take it to the captain, fine. Through me. You do an end run around me again, I'll snap you back so hard you'll think you're a first-year cadet again.
May I speak frankly, sir?
By all means.
You're in my way.
Really? How terrible for you.
All you know how to do is play it safe. I suppose that's why someone like you sits in the shadow of a great man for as long as you have, passing up one command after another. Proceed to Deck 8.
When it comes to this ship and this crew, you're damned right I play it safe.
If you can't make the big decisions, Commander, I suggest you make room for someone who can.
Yeah. That's gold.
Yeah, we'll do that.
But also at the same time, Shelby gives as good as she gets when they're leaving, and you know they're having that discussion. And I think that she does stand up for herself, and it's also telling that they get into the turbo lift. Riker calls halt, and Shelby, you know, calls what is the next
thing
they resume. She does push back on it. It's not that it's just Riker like having a go at her. And you know, it's only a one-sided victory. So again, I like the Shelby character, how strong she's written and how much she's not prepared, you know, how she's prepared to stand up to authority, or in this case, to Riker. It does remind me a lot of Kira in DS9, how she would be, you know, she would also push back. And I thought that had Picard not been there in seasons 4, 5, and 6, I think that this relationship could have evolved into a proper relationship between, you know, captain and first officer.
Okay. Well, before they go into battle, Picard decides to take a walk through the ship, you know, just like Nelson did before the Trafalgar battle. Although Nelson never returned from Trafalgar. And I like Guinan and Picard's talk. I think anytime Guinan shows up, it's gold, don't you? Is there a Guinan hater here?
No. I think it's a great callback, too, because that's the last scene we saw them in Q2 together by themselves in 10 Forward. Here we are again, and it's realistic. There's no one having a drink or whatnot. Everyone's too busy getting ready for the battle and getting all the stuff ready. And Guinan's just sitting around, and it's a really good scene. I think that's her only scene in the entire episode. But yet it seems like she was in it far more than just one, you know, 3-minute scene.
And I have to completely echo that. I think Guinan is absolutely great. The scene that she has with Picard in this episode is fantastic and gives you an insight into the great thing about Guinan and Picard is that it gives them a way of giving an insight into Picard's kind of like emotions and inner feelings without it having to be, you know, him unloading it onto someone within his command chain. So although you can argue that why doesn't Troy perform this role, well, Troy reports to Picard and she's there as part of the crew, whereas Guinan is different. And then similarly, and I think to a lesser extent, but in part two, when they have the Guinan Riker conversation, which arguably could have been a Riker-Troy conversation, but again, I think that is delivered very well, and I think that's exactly what the Riker character at that point in time needed to begin.
All right. Okay. Do you think Riker gets nervous any time Picard says fire at will? What? What did I do?
I've had that joke for a very, very long time.
Oh.
The idea of fire at will and then Riker ducking his head down and screaming, running out from the bridge.
No, leave me alone. Okay. But anyway, the two Borg beam on the ship and distract the crew, but, you know, throwing them around like rag dolls. While the third one comes aboard and abducts Picard, and then the Borg decide to get the hell out of there. It makes you really wonder what they want with Picard, huh? He's going to be go ahead.
I was just going to say, this is by far the biggest nitpick I have in the entire both parts.
Fine.
Still not enough to kill it, but okay, they get Picard. They've got him. Destroy the Enterprise and carry on. Why is it every single time they just leave? Well, you know, it's not going to take, you know, another 10 minutes to destroy the Enterprise and then carry on. I just don't know why they let the Enterprise off every single time.
It's the same reason why 5 people attack 1 person, but the 1 person wins because 4 others dance around menacingly while the 1 person takes them out one by one.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I can come up with. You know. But anyway, but Picard has been chosen to be the voice of the Borg. He's their spokesperson now.
Okay, can I interject? There is a difference, right, between the Borg of Q'hu and the Borg of the best of both worlds in terms of what they do and how they behave and what they're after. And I like the fact that it is referenced on screen that there is this change. Mm-hmm. So there is this change, and it's, I'm not talking about when the Borg are talking to Picard, but I'm talking about when Shelby, I think, and Riker have the conversation and say, you know, I didn't think they were after our biological distinctiveness, or however they want to phrase it. And I like that they acknowledge that previously they thought it was only about tech. Now they're saying that it's also about us as well, and that we're going to be brought into the collective. And in my kind of, you know, Star Trek world, I've just assumed that the Borg of Q, who happened to have stumbled across a very good piece of tech that allowed them now to go out and assimilate people in this way. And between this episode and First Contact, they're going to find out some really, you know, kick-ass nanites that are going to allow them to effectively become, you know, the Borg vampires that they remain for into the end of Voyager.
That's a Data Logan thing I'm hearing there. How did the Borg populate themselves before this moment then, if they didn't assimilate?
Babies. They had babies on Q'hu. They had babies.
A maturation chamber, right?
Yeah, I mean, they got, you know, they got out of their suits, did the deed, and then you know, 9 months later had a little Borg baby.
Ouch, you poked me with your whatever. No, I don't see that. I just don't see it. I can't imagine the Borg actually reproducing before they came across nanotechnology. But they didn't do the nanotechnology yet. They were just thinking about introducing a destructive breed of nanites. They never went anywhere with it.
No, nanoprobes and stuff regarding the Borg side, I don't think comes out until First Contact.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we didn't get a. They really still didn't assimilate anybody. They outfitted him with stuff, but we don't see little tubular holes in his neck. We do see a tube going into his face, but.
We did see them almost sedate him in the neck with some sort of thing. That could have been the early, tubule type thing. And again, I guess this is where 30 years of Star Trek, these writers were writing one episode and didn't really think it would be going 30 years later. So I'm willing to give it a pass. And, they're still a great villain. They're one of my favorites.
Absolutely the best. I think they're one of the best villains, yeah. So Wrecker wants to lead an away team over to get the captain back, but Shelby says, but with my experience... No, shut up. This is what I want to do, until Troy comes in and says that it's inappropriate for you to lead the away team. You're the captain now, in a sense, or you're in charge. And he goes and sits down and broods.
If I was Riker, I would have said, okay, fine. Shelby, you're with Data. Data, lead the away team.
There you go.
You're now, you're second officer. You're next in command of this ship right now. Because Shelby's still not technically attached to this ship.
Mm-mm. No.
Shelby, you're working for him.
Yes. Because she was clearly in charge there. Okay.
But he could have been really nasty and put him on the Geordi, right, in engineering.
Oh, yeah.
Get changed out of red. Go and report to engineering.
No, thank you, sir. No, thanks. Okay, so anyway. But while they're there, they find Picard, and he's already been outfitted with the Borg uniform. That's what I call it. I don't know. Worf tries to get him, but he's stopped by a force field. He's been altered by the Borg.
He is a Borg.
That was pretty good.
Okay, that's a fantastic line. It really is a fantastic line. And you hear the desperation in Worf's voice.
Yes.
And you know that it's hurting Worf that this is the case. Because so from Worf's perspective, and this is why it's so well written, right? If it's Data saying, he is a Borg, it's completely emotionless. If it's Geordi saying, oh, he is a Borg, then it's perhaps overly emotional in a way. But it's Worf, and Worf is... It also brings up issues from from the next episode in part two, where they say if he had died, it would have been easier. Now, from Worf's perspective, as a religious man believing in the glorious afterlife for warriors that have died at the hand of their enemies, this is probably the worst thing that could happen to Picard. Picard hasn't been killed in battle. He's been taken, and he's been changed into a Borg. And I think you can just see the amount of anguish that Worf is going through because of that, and he's not getting his death as he would have liked him to have. And so when Worf says he is a Borg, I interpret there being so much emotion behind that line, and the fact that it was given to Worf, I'm sure they must have done this on purpose.
Bravo, Doc! I never thought of that. That's a very good read on it. I never considered the Klingon after, or you know, the Stovakor aspect. Good.
Yeah, and I think too that, you know, if you jump ahead, whatever, 7-8 years to Voyager, and when we see three Voyager crew members assimilated, totally different impact. Yeah, oh well, they're assimilated, whoop-de-doo. Mm-hmm. We know they can get them back. We didn't know at this time. He's a Borg now. What? It's almost as if this episode keeps digging itself deeper and deeper. And all you keep thinking is, how are they going to get out of this? This is just unbelievable. This is getting worse and worse. And, you know, they needed Q to get out the first time. I don't even think the writers knew what they were going to do with how they were going to get themselves out of this painted corner. But it's certainly thinking, okay, now he's a Borg. Now what? We didn't know you could come back from that. And just added to the stakes.
Yeah, I think it's on record of Michael Piller, who wrote the episode, that he was just, at this point, he was out, he was leaving, and he wrote the episode, you know, without considering at all how it was going to finish, mm-hmm. or how they were going to get out of the predicament they were in. And of course, you know, with whether Patrick Stewart came back or not, they would have to have a different way to get out of it, right? But I have notes here with all of the kind of escalating tensions and them getting deeper and deeper and deeper into the hole. I've got these things like, you know, it almost feels like they're drowning at this point, and it's getting worse and worse and worse and worse. And now you've also got this scene when they come back, and they could have ended this episode two ways. You know, the idea now they've come back with big news that he is the Borg and how they've not managed to get him back. You've also got, you know, they've got this now, this the big weapon that they are going to try to fire, and there's the debate about whether or not they should do it now or get in touch with the Starfleet in order to delay it, and they'll have another chance to use the deflector dish. And I think that it was, you know, when you look at it now, it's great that they end with the firing line, mm-hmm. but you could have very easily seen this as, oh, we went over for our first foray to see if we can get Picard. It turned out he was a Borg. That's the big da-da-da moment. And then you can almost end the episode then, after saying, well, we're not going to blow up our captain. But the fact that they don't do that is, I think it's wonderful. And it also, it leads into the Riker character actually stepping forward and taking command and, you know, acting without the safety net, which was mentioned at the beginning of the episode. This is all wonderful, right? So let me stop gushing here.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right. And they could have stopped it there, but instead, they take a moment for the Borg to just dig the knife in deeper by having Picard tell them, be the one to tell them that resistance is futile. Your life as it has been is over. From this time forward, you will service us. And then you get that moment. So you're right. It's a great ending. So, but unless you guys have anything pressing, then we can't go into it in the next episode. I think it's time for our final thoughts. What do you think?
One small nitpick.
Go ahead.
Which is, they go over to the Borg ship and they say, hell, look at these power wave guide conduits. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, they look mighty like air conditioning to me.
Mm-hmm.
They frankly could have been anything.
Could have been anything. And it only took four of them to get the Borg to stop. Didn't she say that projections predict that, something like that, that a Borg cube like this could run even if 78% of it was
not operational?
Right, and so it only took four conduits to shut them down. Either that or, like, I don't remember, there was another one that just stop and make them itch, you know, make them scratch.
Yeah, that was from Dr. Crusher. So I don't think the ship still worked, but I suspect they just had to come out of warp to reroute auxiliary power, and then they could be on.
Yeah, let's put an end to this, and then we get Mr. Warfire. Okay, so it's now time for our final thoughts and ratings on this episode on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being the worst and 5 being what it deserves. So this is a 3 for me. I really. Okay, it's a 5. It's a 5 all the way for me. The best of both worlds is literally as it's called. You have the best of the Federation, the flagship, and you now have the best enemy that they've ever faced up to this point, the Borg. And here we go, the clash with the best of both worlds. The buildup is interesting to the final 5 minutes. I'd say it'll... I said 5 minutes here, but really it's probably about 20 minutes that since the time they're on the screen, and they one little battle in the Enterprise is tuck tail and run to the Paulson Nebula. And since Q ain't going to get them out of this, they're going to have to come up with some kind of a plan. I guess I might have been able to do without the why doesn't Riker take a promotion thing. But it's good because it proves the Enterprise needed him more now than ever. And we're going to find out in the next episode how thankful he probably is that he didn't take that promotion. Or maybe he would have been able to stop the Borg before the Enterprise got there. Who knows? Picard gets assimilated. He becomes the spokesman. That's terrible. I mean, that just, like I said, it puts a knife in and digs it a little deeper. But as far as a cliffhanger, hey, it was obviously, I think of all Star Trek cliffhangers, this is probably the best cliffhanger there is. I can't imagine Data's head back in San Francisco being any better than this. Not a chance. Or even the Klingon Civil War stuff in season 5, I believe it was. It's still not as good as this. I can't think of any Voyager cliffhanger that was better than this. DS9, well, Blair, maybe you can tell me when you do your synopsis whether you think they had any better cliffhangers. But
they didn't really do cliffhangers in DS9.
I didn't think so, but I mean, there were a few, like, you know, the Defiant limping in space. Everybody wanders off. Sisko goes back home to work with, you know, Dad at the restaurant because he can't handle the stress right now. It seemed like there was a cliffhanger there somewhere in there.
I think there are more story arcs than cliffhangers in DS9. It was, you know, the returning or the episode returning from the season didn't necessarily clean everything up all the time. Mm-hmm. It was more story arc based, or it may have taken a few episodes to continue on. So.
Right, and that's what I think DS9 did a lot better than any other Star Trek series. So, okay. So I remember waiting months to get to the end of this story, and it was pure torture. How would the Enterprise stop the Borg? We'll see in part 2. 5 all the way. Blair is our guest. I'd like you to go next.
Well, I think I've kind of spoken throughout the episode. You can get my feelings for this. I love this episode. I still like the promotion thing because it was a bit of a backstory. And as James kind of said, we all go through this in life where you're at a point where you're comfortable. And do you take the job? Do you not take the job? So on and so forth. So I was okay with that. The Shelby Riker, as much as I didn't like Shelby, it was still a great character. And the conflict between them was fantastic, with sometimes you're siding with Riker, other times you're siding with Shelby. I thought that was really, really good. The music, the build-up, the suspense, and some really, really great one-liners in there that we talked about, whether it's the Riker snapping her head far back or Geordi saying she erred, or one of the iconic Mr. Worf fire. You know, that all just great lines. So I agree. I still, with Lou, I think this is the best cliffhanger in Star Trek, and it's also the best cliffhanger in that the follow-up episode still holds true. Sometimes Star Trek does good cliffhangers, and then the second follow-up episode falls a little flat, as we are going to find out in the next season of The Battle Bridge, that this the cliffhanger or the follow-up episode does hold strong. So as with Lou, I remember this. This was a very, very, very long summer that we had to kind of endure and wondering what was happening. Unfortunately for me, we had some guy at school who happened to get the feed the week before and ruined it for everybody. So the spoiler, this is why I hate spoilers now, and I will never have a movie spoiled. I knew going into the next episode what had happened, and it's kind of a shame that I did, but still fantastic episode. And I will rate this episode 5.0 Borg cubes.
Mm. Oh, that's another thing you guys do I like. And I've actually been wondering how I could possibly do that. But I can't come up with what you and Smosky come up with. And so
Chris has some great alliteration, too.
Chris, yeah, Chris does, too. You're right. So I can't do that. I'm going to try someday. Actually, I've got an intro that I've been wanting to try on somebody, you know, when we bring a guest on, but haven't had the nerve to do it yet. So, okay, Doc, how about you?
Okay, so this is absolutely a five-star episode. As we've spoken about right through the last couple of hours, I think this is terrific. I think this really does stand up. I'm putting this as my favorite episode of Trek of the series so far. I'm not entirely convinced it's going to get knocked off. I really do think it's wonderful. I remember watching it as a kid and absolutely terrified about the threat that was there, and really not knowing how they're going to be getting out of it. And I don't think they are overbuilding up to the point where they can't get out of it without some type of, you know, magic wand. I think we'll obviously discuss what happened in part two, but I don't have a problem at all with part two and how they, you know, how they get out of it in the end. I thought, as I spoke, I thought the Shelby character was fantastic. It was very good as introduced, right? So, you know, whether you like Shelby or not, the fact that this episode has Shelby in it, has another character coming in to give a different dynamic, is important. I think had you had this storyline without the external individual, I think it would be slightly flatter. We didn't actually say, and I'm sure you're going to put it at the end, Lou, about the, you know, Mr. Worf fire line with the music that follows it and the black screen makes this particular cliffhanger, you know, absolutely superb. There's actually a couple of lines that I'm going to quote from when Picard goes onto the Borg cube that I think is just wonderful and sums up why the Borg is so terrifying. And it's, you know, when he's having the exchange with the disembodied voice and he's trying to tell them about how, you know, how our society is set up, and then what comes back is, you know, freedom is irrelevant and self-determination is irrelevant and you must comply. And he hits them with, well, no, you know, we'd rather die, and the death is irrelevant coming back, is something that always stood with me, because, you know, how the hell do you argue with that, right? If you've actually got to the point where they consider that to be irrelevant, then where do we go from here? What's the common ground?
Oh.
And I thought that I remember watching this as a 12-year-old kid and thinking, you know, this is just superb. And it still holds up. I enjoyed it today as much as I've, you know, as I remember ever having done. So straight fives all round.
Yes, it is. And for the end of season three as a whole here, our average comes out to 3.82 for me, 3.88 for James, and 4.36 for the guests. So it's still proving they like Star Trek more than us. So, okay, Blair, remind everybody where they could find you.
Well, I'm on Upper Pylon 2. I'm one of the co-hosts there. Mm. We drop our shows every Thursday. And I'm also on the TrekMateFamily.com forums if you'd like to see some of the posts we make. And I'm also on Twitter at Medic1849.
All right, then. So now here's a decision that I've been asking that we have not settled, James. When are they going to hear the next episode? Are we going to put it on next week, or are we going to make them wait a couple months for the outcome of this story?
Oh. Okay, I like what you did there. I think that we should be kind and let them have it in the next week.
Okay.
Next time on Star Trek The Next Generation. You once knew him as Picard, captain of the Starship Enterprise, but now he's half man, half machine, a deadly pawn of the evil Borg. His mission, to destroy Earth and anything or anyone who gets in his way. It's the showdown of the 24th century on the next exciting episode of Star Trek The Next Generation.
All right, guys, he's made the decision. So join us next week as we review Season 4, Episode 1. It's called The Best of Both Worlds, Part 2. And do you guys consider this the second of a two-story arc? Or the second of a three-story arc with family?
Second of two.
Two of two.
Yeah, I was going to say
two of two.
It's two of two, and I wasn't going to... I don't want to upset people, but I think it's two of two.
Okay. And you can decide in the forums if it's two or three, two of three, or... I'm not doing Borg thing here. Is it two of three or two of two? So... thank you for downloading tonight, and we're going to end this with the great Commander Riker.
Good night.
Good night, everybody.
Go for it, Will.
Mr. Worf. Fire.